Roger, I think I've got you on high gain now.
Roger.
Got us locked up there, telecom.
Okay, it's just real weak, flight.
Okay, how are you looking? All your systems go?
That's a firm flight.
How about you, control?
We look good.
Guidance, you happy?
Go, those systems.
Fido, how about you?
We're go.
Roger. We're a little low, flight.
Roger.
Roger, pitch 212, yaw plus 37.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Kane and Rince podcast, volume 13, issue 623. And today we're going to be talking about two games, and some others, actually, but mainly Lunar Lander and Lunar Rescue. Joining me, Leon Cox, in this issue, Brian Edwards.
Hello, hello.
Chris Worthington.
Hello.
And Tony Atkins.
Hello.
Lunar Lander and Lunar Rescue are completely unrelated moon landing based arcade machines from 1979, sort of. I say sort of because the second one, Lunar Rescue, is less of a... I mean, it is, but you listen on and find out. If you're wondering, if you're new to Kane and Rince and you're wondering why in the last show we talked about one of the newest big budget, high profile games from the last 3 years, and this week we're talking about two relatively niche coin ops from the late 70s, that's because that's what we do. Lunar Lander, then, is where we're going to start. Now, in terms of histories, I don't know if any of us, even me, I'm the oldest here, has seen one of these actually in an arcade. To be honest, I can't even remember, but I don't remember seeing one. I don't remember seeing one in a sort of museum or a retro revival arcade either. I think they're relatively rare, and I've only played this on various emulation compilations and things like that. And as we will discuss, there have been any number of clones and follow-ups. So I'm wondering, other than really for me, even though I've been aware of this game since, I guess, a long time, I've only really dabbled with it in relatively recent times. Does anyone have any kind of more history than they played it for the podcast because I asked them to?
I actually have played both of these cabinets.
Very cool.
I'm very lucky geographically where I live in the United States. And I have a couple friends of mine who are as enthusiastic about video games as I have, that I have made several trips to both Fun Spot, which is in New Hampshire, which is the arcade that the King of Kong documentary was filmed at, which has a retro arcade museum upstairs with over 500 cabinets up there. They have the selection is kind of incredible. And I'm also equidistant to Galloping Ghost in Illinois, which they both tout themselves as the largest arcades in the world. Galloping Ghost is the arcade I sent very excited McKeel Croder of a picture of me playing Primal Rage 2, the only one that was in existence that is there.
Yeah.
So I'm lucky enough to have put hands on both these cabinets actually relatively recently, within the last 4 or 5 years. But I never saw either of these when I was like a child going to arcades.
No, sure. Chris, any further back?
No, I've certainly never seen. I've played Lunar Rescue, but Lunar Lander I've never seen in the wild. I'd love to, because I'm sure you're going to describe the cab. It's very, very cool.
The way you
control the thrust. In terms of my history with the game, though, I actually played it for the first time when I picked up the Atari 50 collection for the Switch.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was my first experience playing the actual Lunar Lander game. But my word, I feel like I've been playing this game my whole life, right? Because
yeah.
I must have played clones, variations of this.
Yeah, not
for as far back as I can remember.
I think my actual first experience with Lunar Lander may have been Astro Lander in Time Splitters 2, to be honest. That might be one of my first experiences playing
about
this
that one.
Game. Yeah. I was thinking about it. I was trying to dial it down, but yeah, like you said, different variations.
Chris, did you want to describe the cam then?
So it's got, and Brian maybe is the better candidate to do this.
Yeah,
but Brian, you will know more from actual experience. But it's got that big the thrust handle, hasn't it? That you can actually pull back on
to
make the thrust. I mean, that must be so tactile and cool in your hands.
It's It's cool. It feels very wonky. It's like it's like one of those things. It feels like a novelty, you know, kind of machine as you're playing it. I'm not sure. It actually kind of reminds me. There's another obscure arcade game called Tunnel Hunt that has a similar. It's more of a joystick feel than the thrust itself. But yeah, it's kind of wild. It's interesting because they've had multiple of the arcade one-up cabinets have come out with a smattering of emulated versions of these. And the one-up arcade cabinet, my buddy Tom has it, who I was a friend for. I went over to his house to play Lunar Lander. I'm like, oh, yeah, I remember the thrust. And then I got there, and the arcade one-up, of course, just has those buttons. I was like, oh, yeah. I forgot, you know? So, yeah, I've only had hands on it, like I said, just a few times. But, yeah, it's pretty neat. It has a little bit. It's a lot has to do with the, you can't get this feeling that much on the Atari 50, but it's there. If you turn the volume up, that when you touch that stick, that like whoosh of the thrust sound, which is really kind of the only noise in the game, it's almost deafening. So it really, even though it doesn't feel necessarily, like you said, tactile, that doesn't have that much like feel to it. It's that combined with the sound that makes you feel like you're really, you know, when you're coming in hot or when you're burning too much fuel. It's pretty neat. Yeah.
Tony, were you familiar at all with this before I made you play it?
No, absolutely familiar with it. I think it is one of those games that are just in the lexicon of history where you can see a screen and know exactly what it is. Whether I'm like Chris, whether I'm remembering playing a game similar to this, but I am sure I have had hands on this. I went back and looked with the extensive amount of releases it had across multiple different platforms and versions. Yeah. And the only one I can really pick out is that I could have played it on a BBC Micro, which we had.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a very definite possibility, because my brother had a BBC Micro and he collected a lot of games for it. And it would make sense that wasn't huge amounts of games on that console.
Yeah, for sure.
So I feel like I've definitely played it. But obviously, you know, I played it, I think, like most people here on the Atari 50 collection, just the easiest way to access something like that now. So yeah, been playing that. I kind of did my research and watched some people on the actual cabinet, because I always find that, you know, what was the actual experience like upon release? And yeah, it's a really cool cabinet, and they even opened up the inside of the cabinet, and it just for such a simple game, it just surprised me how many boards were inside this cabinet and how big everything lit, all the switches were to make what essentially is
old tech.
Really simple mechanical game. But I guess it had to also power the screen and power the yoke control type thing and all the other things that came with it. But that was kind of cool and fascinating. Whether that is the same one they had in the Funko, I don't know. But more recent time, I just played it for the show.
So, yeah, there are... first thing we should say is, as with Star Raiders, another 1979 game we've covered recently... This has its roots even more so than that one in text-based games, university projects and the like. Chris, I think you had a look into this. I don't know if you managed to... I don't know if there are any versions out there playable, but essentially it was... originally, it was more of a kind of, I guess, scientific simulation where you type stuff in. And obviously the version we're mainly talking about is the Atari coin-op version, which is designed to be... played in the arcade space and is pretty punishing and whatever else. But it goes back to something that you might have, if you'd been lucky enough to go to a school or a college in the mid 70s with a computer, you might have been able to try your hand at landing on the moon via that.
Yeah, you know, and I think in some ways I found it more exciting than the arcade game. Weird kind of right.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there's more left to the imagination. That's why I managed to track down a version online. Just very simple Google search. What obviously I don't know is whether it said in the description of the game that it was a recreation of the code of the original 1969 game.
69, is that how far it goes back?
Well, I think the moon landing was 69, right? And I think the first report of the text-based game being seen, being played... was about 3 months later.
That's incredible.
So, and it was a 16 or 17 year old kiddie in school who said, "Oh, that'd be fun to simulate, wouldn't it?" And
Oh, can you imagine? I mean, we're all born after the moon landing. Even I was born after the moon landing. Grew up in a time when obviously sci-fi was booming, particularly space opera, fantasy sci-fi, rather than the more, you know, cerebral stuff, perhaps. But it was just everyone's imaginations must have been just captured by that moment. You know, still a huge moment for man. I think we as in humanity has recently sent some things back up to the moon, and I think there are going to be manned missions to the moon again soon. But I don't think nothing will ever in our lifetimes recreate the sheer spectacle that must have been
flying
watching
cars
it live.
That's my thing.
But, well, yeah,
I want
flying
a flying
cars,
car.
Hoverboards, yeah, all that.
Yeah, but the problem is that's just going to be some rich idiot, isn't it, who just does it for a vanity project, and then we'll all hate it and get really cynical about it, whereas that felt like something it really did take the whole public with them. But just this is where I feel like I'm out of time. Just imagine seeing something like that, which captures your imagination, and the way in which you express your excitement is you go into school the next day and create a computer game about it.
Yeah. Well, I guess that still happens to indie developers, maybe. I don't know. But,
but I mean, think back to when we turned 16 or 17, some of the formative things that happened to me in the 90s, you know. I would have loved to have just gone into school and like, you know what? I've watched the Prodigy play last night on Top of the Pops. I'm going to go make a video game of it. You know, it's just
I feel that's kind of, I sound weird, but I feel like it's almost more relevant back then because I, you know, like I had the BBC and stuff like that where, you know, by default, they come with some sort of programming book, you know, almost to get these things up and running. There was there was a level of language or computer language that you kind of needed to pass, say, to get through the door.
Sometimes you even had to load in a cartridge or a disc to have a programming language at your disposal.
So that's a bit before my time. So I'm fine with that. But I do remember people like, okay, to even get this up and running, you need to put a line of code to get something on. But I definitely remember having a book where I put stuff in and watched a very rudimentary stuff. And I'm not saying that kids today, but, you know, the accessibility of those is more powerful than ever, but it's almost like, you know, the levels of what you can achieve needs to be so much higher as well today than it probably was back then, which, you know, you're quite happy with just one line in code coming across the screen. And look, I made a line go across the screen. That's cool.
But just on the game itself, I mean, I found it genuinely quite exciting. I mean, so you all it is you input how much fuel you want to burn during that 10-second interval. And then the program will update and it will tell you, right, at this point now, the altitude is this, the burn rate is this, the velocity is this, and then you adjust the fuel burn to...
But it's a math puzzle.
Pretty much.
The real thing, only a bit less complicated. Yeah.
just a touch less complicated. I'd like to think there was a little bit more to it in 1969, but... In terms of a game, and you can see your altitude's getting lower and your ship's getting faster or slower, and it genuinely was quite thrilling. I mean, it wouldn't be something that you'd spend a huge amount of time on, but for a few minutes, actually felt the lack of visuals increased the tension and excitement. Mm-hmm. I thought it was good.
Not to get too, like, I don't know what the word is, or romantic about it, or even talking about, like, the state of education or anything. It's just like... It, like, how many students in those times, how many students in your time were you one of these students who felt like when a teacher explained something to you or showed you how to do something on the board or what have you, you didn't get it. But if you did it yourself, if you had a, like, I was always like, I could never listen to a teacher explain math to me. But if you gave me an abacus and then showed me the three sets of threes made nine, like, I could figure that out. And then, so you had a kid that was that. Like that tactile was like, well, let's this cool thing that I've seen, this amazing achievement of man. Let's see what I can do and make it somehow this interactive experience and what that potentially could teach to those that wouldn't be able to learn normally. It just the implications of the power of that is still like, it's so
amazing. Gamification of learning goes back a long way.
Yeah. And then you combine that with what you were saying, Leanne, about like how the computers that we use when we were kids at various levels of age that all four of us have, right? Like even for myself, the first computer that we ever had in our home, because things like the Spectrum and they weren't as common in the United States. So my first machine was a Windows 3.1 machine, but I still had to go out to DOS to load anything that I thought was cool.
Yeah.
Right. So I was like, you know, just looking at a C prompt and trying to figure stuff out. What did I do? You know, I felt like, yeah, exactly. I felt like if I just type Doom in, will Doom be on this computer? Of course it wouldn't. But like, you know, like it's just.
Now you can just fire up your smartphone, go into an anonymous browser tab, and literally hack the Pentagon.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Yeah, it's wild to think the implications of that. While we all know how limited those machines and the technology was, but like it must have felt so vast and unending, the potential of what could be, and that's that excitement. You know, that technology is incredible, and having the world at our fingertips is undoubtedly a overwhelmingly good thing, but the mystery that you lack now is something tangible.
Yeah.
But if you think about the fundamentals of the game as well, it's got a win state, a lose state, and threat, jeopardy. And to my mind, those three things, if you get them together in the right way, they can make a pretty good game, no matter how simple it is.
Right.
And this has all three of those things.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was made for the Atari 6502-based arcade system by Atari, developed at Atari and published by them, designed and engineered by Wendy Allen and Rich Moore, and it was released August 79, which, of course, was almost 10 years exactly after the 16th of July 1969 moon landing. 10 years seemed like a lot when I was 7 years old, because it was before I was born, but actually... it's not really any time at all.
No,
10 years is not a long time. If you think about what was going on in 2014, just give you a pause to do that. That's 10 years ago, and so this was 10 years after the moon landing. And by the way, just a quick recommendation: if you do ever want, if you feel like the whole moon landing thing either is something that passed you by or you've never quite understood kind of what it meant, there's a documentary from 2019 simply called Apollo 11, directed by Todd Douglas Miller, and it just basically covers that mission but manages to make it feel incredibly immediate and new and fresh and dramatic and dynamic, and can't recommend it strongly enough. I'm not sure where it's available at the moment, but I'm sure you can find it somewhere. You have been able to play Lunar Lander, either the original via emulation or in some cases conversion on various systems, going all the way back to, as well as all those versions that we've previously mentioned on every home computer and console you can think of. It's been released on PC, PS2 and Xbox as part of an Atari compilation. There was an Atari Flashback 2 console. There was a version for Game Boy Advance. There was a version for DS, a version for N-Gage, a version for PSP. All different developers. Code Mystics have done some emulated versions. Destination Software did the GBA version. Taneko did the DS version. Digital Eclipse did the N-Gage version, and we'll hear more from them. The Atari Classics Evolved compilation on PSP is by Stainless Games and has a sort of upgraded, if you will, 60 FPS looking version. Lunar Lander did, and I'd forgotten about this, came out on Game Room by Chrome for the Xbox 360 and PC in 2010. The short-lived but much missed arcade on a console concept that Microsoft came up with and then fairly rapidly abandoned. But it had some cool games that you don't see in many other places on it. And of course, it's now basically lost.
Do you know who ported that one, Leon? Who developed that?
That's Chrome. Yeah,
oh,
so
Chrome,
formerly
right.
Melbourne House.
Okay. Wow.
Australian studio. Yeah. Mm. There's been the Atari Flashback versions, which are easy enough to get hold of, and Volumes 1 and 2 are currently part of possibly both Game Pass and PlayStation Plus. Anyway, they're on PS4, Xbox One, PC and Switch. That's Code Mystics as well. The game appears on streaming, on AntStream, and a service called Plex, which I believe has also shut down. But the version I think we'd recommend, and we've recommended this compilation a lot on this podcast for good reason, is Atari 50, the anniversary celebration by Modern Digital Eclipse on all current formats And that came out a couple of years ago in 2022. And yeah, like everything on that compilation, the emulation is spot on. They've made a real effort to recreate that thing that is so hard to recreate on a modern screen, which is vectors. And I think they've done a decent job.
Yeah. Yeah, particularly on a OLED switch playing in handheld. I think the the emulated vectors really pop off the screen. It's a lovely way to play it.
I think it's even more pronounced. Well, not pronounced because the emulation is kind of what you're there for. But in some of their more reimagined titles too, there's a particularly good one on there that involves Lunar Lander called Vector Sector.
I was playing that just before we jumped on.
That. My friends and I have a bit of a high score thread going back forth on that. It's doing that fake vector thing so well that it's almost believable. And then until you see vectors again in real life, and it's just like the way those lines like sing, you know, like how bright they actually are. It's clearly, but probably as good as it can possibly get, you know, with your flat screen TV.
Yeah. Vector fetishists. Don't forget to check out our Vectrex console special podcast, which is still available.
You know,
Lunar Lander.
Just before you move on, you know, going back to some of those versions you've just mentioned, I'm not talking about the emulator versions, but on the likes of the GBA and around that time, you know, it's funny how difficult it obviously was to get this right. You know, for an old game, this is a 1979 game, you would have thought that by the time something like the GBA came along in 2000, in the early 2000s, that'd be a doddle, right? You know, you just make an arcade perfect of Lunar Lander and jobs are good.
Resolution's just way, way too low. And
but
it's,
just the feel of it as well. And the feel it of just it. Doesn't
digital inputs. Yeah.
It just doesn't feel right. And it's obviously something, despite how simple a game it is, just to get the feel of the arcade is obviously much more difficult than it would seem to the untrained.
Well, I think actually quite often the more simpler the game, the harder it is because, you know, there is no place to hide. You can't hide behind one thing, the odd frame here or there. Yeah. If it's Lunar Lander, if you get the odd frame wrong, then it's mission over. It's just as simple as
that's
that.
That's very true. Yeah. And even the resolution comes into play because you've got that very, you've got to be very precise about how level your ship is.
I have disagreed a few times on my runs of Lunar Lander at how level my ship was compared to what it believed it was.
A big screen helps, actually.
I played it on the Asus ROG Ally. It seemed just like I tried it on the big screen. It was fine. Yeah. But it just felt like, almost like Chris was saying, just felt so natural in playing a game like that in the hand. And and actually, because like most of these emulations, you have the ability to keep it in the original, you know, original size or squared up or wide. And those other two versions were just felt awful. Like trying to play it kind of pulled out as a wide version. Just was like, no, this, it clearly.
Digital Eclipse did a nice job with the wallpapers. So use those.
Yeah, absolutely.
For sure. Lunar Lander proved moderately commercially successful, according to Wikipedia, selling 4,830 cabinets. Don't know how many they made. And I don't know what the price was back then, but obviously Atari was happy enough.
They thought that did really well, didn't they? And then they released Asteroids.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
Yeah. I guess so. But it probably helped pave the way in many ways, technically, technologically, and commercially. So.
Well, I think if you're lucky enough to own, or if you've played a very early version of Asteroids, chances are it started life as Lunar Lander.
Right.
Because most of the early Asteroid boards, or a lot of the early Asteroid boards, were conversion kits for Lunar Lander.
They did not retain the analog thrust control, sadly. Yeah. Asteroids had plenty buttons even without that.
Yeah.
So Lunar Lander, according to Moby Games, is based on other variants of Lunar Lander, also known by other names such as LEM or LEM. Popular on mainframes and early home computers, this version of the game features vector graphics and requires input in real time. The goal for the player is to land on the moon by applying thrust to the lander in different directions. If the player hits the moon with too much velocity or lands on uneven terrain, Tony, the lander will crash. When things tend to go wrong... That's interesting wording. When things are going wrong... The player can press the abort button to quickly launch the lander back up again. The abort action and applying thrust costs precious fuel, of which the player only has a limited amount. We've already talked about the visuals a bit, but I think it does tie nicely in. It's a feeling that I've tried to sort of express on podcasts before, and I don't know if I've ever managed to successfully bring it across again, particularly that to those who weren't around back in the late 70s to kind of see this technology when it was new. But even though I can't speak to Lunar Lander specifically, I probably spoke on the Asteroids podcast about the very particular excitement that came with being a 7-year-old child or whatever in front of an inky black vector monitor that was sparkling with these super high resolution, albeit monochrome, single color lit up images, pixels that actually glowed. And yeah, it felt like you were, to me then as a 7-year-old kid, you know, fresh off Star Wars and all that, it felt like you were entering a kind of new universe. It, again, I've said it so many times, it's hard to actually, I imagine now, because, you know, the technology we carry around with us is so phenomenally, astronomically, exponentially more sophisticated. But this was in a world where computers were very new and unknown.
I think you could still appreciate a lot of that if you've ever played a vector game in the cabinet form. I must have been 9-ish, our local bowling alley had a couple arcade games in it. So we'd go down there and play. They had Crystal Castles. I've talked about that before. And a couple other games that I hold a lot dear. And one day I showed up, and not knowing myself that this was a little bit of an older game, there was a Tempest cabinet there. And looking at Tempest and seeing those graphics and seeing that, like, it has such a different look. Not necessarily feel, but like that because of how it looks, you think it has a different feel. Or like, for example, the Star Wars arcade machine. And like there's just the way that those vector lines sparkle back at you is something. And if you were able to see that as a child, it's hard to put that into words. And even now as an adult, those are just games. It doesn't. Black Widow is another one. Like, it just, you walk by these cabinets and they call out to you. They call out to me, at least. In a way, just because of how those visuals look, it's unique. And then speaking specifically about Lunar Lander, there's some subtle, really nice animation. I know it sounds ridiculous talking about this from a 1979 game, but man, that thruster animation still just top tier. I mean, like, what it's able to convey with its limited tool set is quite astounding.
Just a triangle that flickers, but it varies in size.
I think Brian's right there. I mean, there is still something special looking about vector games today. I was at an arcade just a couple of weeks ago playing Star Wars arcade. Yeah. And I mean, that's obviously a much more sophisticated looking game than this, but there is something about those vector graphics, even now in a dark room, which are so much different to all the kind of raster stuff and the stuff that we see on the consoles, which...
It's true.
Yeah, it is something special even still.
It's funny that we keep mentioning the Star Wars game, so I kept thinking about, what was the recent vector game we played? And it was actually, we covered Star Wars for the podcast, and having a quick look, so that's 83. So it's only 4 years after. And like, the jump between...
Yeah, massive.
Something like Lunar Lander and Star Wars is incredible, really.
Well, this was the first.
Even just from the vector graphics and the obviously colour and everything.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, so this was... the vector monitor was developed by someone called Rick Moncrief, who would go on to be the project leader on the hard drive-in game and race drive-in 10 years after this, which were also known as being technical kind of... marvels at the time, with solid polygons rather than vectors and line graphics. I mean, the other thing that I wanted to say about this, as I say, I'm not speaking 100% from experience, but based on around other experiences I had at the time of other games and feelings. Although I think it becomes apparent playing Lunar Lander now that perhaps there isn't enough to it to keep our attention in 2024. Mm-hmm. Because there is literally one aim to the game, yeah. which is land your ship.
Yeah.
Now, there is a bit more to it than that, we'll go into, but that is it. That is land your ship, don't crash, then do it again. That is it. And it with the advent of Asteroids and all the other games, obviously Space Invaders was already out at this point. There was more, it was kind of maybe not more intense. Lunar Lander's pretty intense. But kind of just more going on, more happening, more ability threat. To fire back, more threat. Yeah, all that stuff. So, however, what would have been a hugely appealing aspect at the time was if I watched stuff on TV as a kid, Tomorrow's World or science programs, whatever else, and they would have shown NASA HQ and astronauts doing their thing. They would have had those kind of old oscilloscopes and, you know, screens that had just like dots on them. And even in fictional stuff like Star Trek had its readouts and its, you know, its LEDs. It was all, obviously that was all faked and lights and cellophane and bit knobs and whatever. But playing Lunar Lander, walking up to that machine, it almost felt like it could have been a simulation, like the combination of the complexity of the physics on display, the very obvious inertia and gravity, also the presentation of it gave it an authenticity.
Yeah, I think your imagination does the rest, doesn't it? And you can almost imagine a mission control. You try hard enough, you can imagine mission control in your ears, you know, telling you about totally. Other things going yeah. on and. So yeah, there is stuff that you can fill in, but I agree with that in a lot of ways. Yes, there is an argument to say on a very basic level, it's too simplistic now to really enjoy. But I think if you put yourself in the headspace of what it must have been like playing this only 10 years after the lunar landings,
totally.
I think it's easy to imagine how it can be more thrilling than it first appears.
Also, it is a machine that's trying to suck people's money. So,
no
doubt.
So when I sat down and obviously played, I like all of this, I was almost like, so it's just this one screen, right? And so obviously the difficulty, and we'll get into how that changes. But it was there was an initial like, wow, that's bare, but like really bare bones. Like it's going to take a while to, you know, okay. But then I kind of think about, you know, where was its purpose? And its purpose was there to sit in the corner, entice people. And you know, it wasn't like you need to now play this for 20 hours. It was like, okay, here's put a, I have no idea how much this would have cost.
Would have been
then.
A quarter, I expect.
I was about to say a quarter, but really
10
I didn't
pence
know.
Or a quarter. Yeah.
Yeah, a quarter was kind of the going rate for all those machines back then.
20p here.
Stick a quarter in, and the first time you're more likely going to crash your ship. You know, stick a second quarter in.
Very quickly.
And quickly you would have learned, okay, this is what... But I could see someone losing a buck or two straight into there and not being frustrated by that experience. And I kind of think, you know, taking it into context of time, place, what it was... it's fine. Like, it's absolutely and fine. And in fact, playing it in a modern day setting, I'm more than happier for a game to be like this, where I'm not trying to rack my brains around and going, what is this asking me to do?
It was more of a novelty and an experience in the same way as the Forerunners that were electromechanical cabinets. It wasn't necessarily, although it has a scoring system, it wasn't necessarily a game that you might say, hey, I just got a, you know, 800 point landing or whatever. And can you beat that, Dad? You know, that kind of thing. But I don't think it would have been, you wouldn't have been like going down there week after week. And maybe some people did. Maybe some people thoroughly got into it. I don't know.
This is something that I've come to appreciate way more as an adult with small children than I did when I was a small child. But I will say the allure of an arcade machine that has something other than a joystick and buttons on it to a child, you know, like that big landing stick, it reminded me so much. Like, how many times did I go over to the, you know, whatever driving game machine and just shift the Spy Hunter machine and just go from high to low, high to low.
Oh,
just, even though there was no money in the machine, I was just eight and I was just messing with that, you know, and like there's something, it's a novelty control scheme, which will by its nature, at least in my experience, be like, well, I don't know if I'm like this, but it's worth a quarter just to see how this works. You
but
know?
Anecdotally, so, I mean, I've tried to get my kids into different games over the years. You know, they are the typical breed of kid nowadays that, you know, seems that, you know, their favorite experiences seem to be based around Fortnite or Roblox. And as much as I try, you know, that's, they love and that's what they'll continue on, and Minecraft. And, but, you know, they, in particular with Lunar Lander, they were just like, what is that insinuous, well, just noise of like beep, beep, beep with the fuel indicator going off and off and off. And, yeah. You know, bless, I got managed to get one of my daughters to sit down and give it a go. And, you know, at the start, she's kind of like eyes rolling. But then she's like, no, I just want one more go. I just want one more go. I just want one more. Yeah. And I thought, you know what? Sometimes just super simple stuff like this really can just play for a, you know, a new modern audience, because it's not asking anything much more than super simple things. But as we said earlier, you know, it's kind of got those three aspects of what it wants you to do, and that's so easy to get into. But from a, yeah, an arcade cabinet experience, I almost felt like that transgendered into like 2024 with my daughter kind of going, oh yeah, just give us a go. And I could see how, yeah, she would have spent a quarter, you know, and just it, yeah, it still works many years down the line.
And I would say even now there's an allure to cabinets that you know that you can't accurately emulate at home. Yeah. A lot of the golden age of arcade games, you know, it was just a stick and it was three or four buttons, or it was six buttons. You can buy an arcade stick it, plug it in your computer, USB, job done. You haven't got exactly the same experience as in the arcade, but it's as close as damn it to it. Mm-hmm. Whereas something like this, which has a slightly unique cab or the, you know, we keep going back to the Star Wars, but even that with its yoke, that is an experience that you can't easily replicate at home. So these cabinets will always have a special allure. I think if you took them to a room full of enthusiasts, I would say that, yeah, there'd probably be more interest in this bespoke particular cabinet like this than there would be in, you know, an inverted commas better game in a more regular cab.
It's funny, we go on these trips, as I mentioned before, and I'm lucky enough to be able to do just about one a year that we've gone for the last 4 or 5 years. And you would, when we first went on our first one, we're like, oh, it's going to be great. We're going to play a lot of Street Fighter, Mortal Kombat 2, and all these things. And yeah, you can, but we can do that at home. You know, yeah, like, exactly. You can do that anywhere. Fortunately, you know, that's how great emulation is, how great controllers have gotten, and accessibility and all those things. But you know, you can't play Quantum with this giant trackball, or Missile Command with that giant, you know, and like all the three button, like with,
which
those
is
are
why
games.
The arcades are full of the event cabinets, novelty machines, and, yeah, you know, sit downs, yeah, and ride ons and shoot things and whatever now, because you're not going to have a whole set of those.
Exactly.
At home.
Yeah. It's pretty cool that way. So that's what makes them, like you said, the museum quality more alluring, especially now. Yeah.
And again, I don't want to oversell this, but I do want to communicate it. We talked about the audio and how minimal it is, and obviously how minimal the graphics are, but again, for me, that actually helps sell it as a, obviously I'm aware that it's as old as it is, 45 years old, but it helps sell it as a authentic piece of kind of science memorabilia, do you know what I mean, rather than it being a bangy whizzy shooty game, which I adore, obviously. It has this austerity about it, which kind of befits the subject matter. This, you know, as cool as the space race was, it was also so much about maths geniuses and the advance of science. It wasn't about being Luke Skywalker. It was about being, you know, working on stuff that was, you know, Einstein Hawking levels of mathematical understanding, to make sure that the astronauts didn't just plummet into the surface of the moon. And actually, you know, even in its very simplistic way, with its limited controls, this game will make you feel that landing on the moon was extraordinarily hard. And if you play this alongside watching the documentary I mentioned earlier, it might give you a new level of appreciation for what those crazy, crazy people did when they agreed to go up in that capsule and try to land on the surface of another orbiting satellite.
You know, it's funny when I think about the moon lander or that period of time, because for them it's like they were using cutting edge technology, and yes, now you kind of look in your mind eye and think, how the hell did they manage, yes, to pull that off?
You must have been to the science museum and looked absolutely at the, you know, capsule, right?
Absolutely.
And it's just like, yeah, it's just a little tin.
You just,
right,
look at and go, everyone always says, oh, your phone's like 10 times more powerful, and you're just thinking, they did something incredible with such, well, that is history, I mean, it's humankind.
And you're also thinking, I ain't getting in that, and being basically launched into space on a missile. I mean, the whole thing beggars belief, perhaps bonkers to a fault in the case of too many people. Yeah. Some other things of note about this game is that it zooms in, right? Which was not something had been seen before. The first arcade game, according to Atari 50, to change the player's perspective, which is something actually that a lot of games would go on to do. You'd have different sections with a different scaled character or whatever. But here, you're going from this zoomed out view to something much closer to the action, and it obviously calculates whereabouts on the map you're going to be. My one disappointment, and I'd actually never clocked this until a few days ago, is that there is only one lunar surface you get to land on. I had in my head there were different ones, or it was procedurally generated or something.
Yeah,
sadly not. That's something that would have added a lot potentially of longevity to the game, along with a few other mechanical tweaks. But yes, it is just the one. It's got a big mountain in the middle and a few wrinkles up and down the side. What it does semi-randomly generate, I suppose, is where the landing pads are.
That's correct. Yeah, that's it. And you know that landscape came from a graphical representation of this game from 1973?
I did not know that.
So when Wendy Allen asked Rich Moore if he fancied working on a lunar lander game,
right,
he said, yeah, and I've seen one. I've seen a graphical one, which was controlled by a ballpoint pen. It was this landscape was this, and it looks, I've only ever seen a still, but it looks just like the 1979 arcade game, but they controlled the movement and the thrust with a light pen that depended on how close to the screen it was.
It's the DS version.
The thrust, yeah, exactly. A little bit early. And Rich Moore designed the landscape from memory and copied that landscape from what he could remember of seeing it in 1973.
So obviously, games that came after, both from Atari and elsewhere, would go on to have multiple levels and screens and whatever else. But the one we're talking about simply has the one. And it will then generate a selection of landing pads, and it will offer you, this is where the game is a bit more gamey than just pure simulation, is different landing pads give you different multipliers. And that didn't happen on the moon.
No, I was just imagining, like, there, guys, look, X2.
Right, times four. Let's go for that one.
Risk reward here, guys.
We're almost out of fuel. Hey, they were almost out of fuel.
Screw the Sea of Tranquility. There's a 5X over there I got to get to.
So yeah, risk reward is the name of the game, and essentially so you start off and you're dropped into the atmosphere, and then it's about managing your trajectory, your throttle, your thrust. You have information on the screen telling you how fast you're going in each direction, and you try to set it down incredibly gently, and then it will grade you on your landing. Which actually reminded me of a game we have talked about before, Pilot Wings 64, and Pilot Wings. And then you do it all over again, or not, if you don't have enough fuel left, more likely. Yeah. I noted with interest that the only dip switches available to the arcade operator were in control of your starting fuel, which there are quite a few selections, but the lowest is 450, which is incredibly mean.
Very tight.
You would potentially struggle to even get down once on that. But you can set it up to 1800, which potentially would give you a few landings. And then you could actually have some kind of high score competition, because what I find on the 750 default is that it's quite hard to do more than a couple of landings before you're just not going to have enough fuel left to bring her in.
And I was the classic example of, like, just modern day gaming. I was like, well, if I land, presumably it's going to give me some fuel back for my achievement, my accomplishments. And I landed again. I was like, excellent. Well, what am I meant to do with this remaining 20 fuel? I guess just
die. You want some more fuel? The coin slot's right there for you.
Exactly. But it was just that classic of, like, okay.
What's also interesting about the way that the game handles its difficulty is that you can select it on the fly. There's a button for difficulty, which you can press during gameplay, and it affects it in real time. The only thing is, and this is, as far as I'm concerned, in ludological terms, the biggest oversight of the game, right? It doesn't affect how many points you get, I don't think.
Not that I could see, no.
Because you can land it on training, and you have less in terms of gravity friction and inertial rotation to worry about.
Yeah.
and then you can do it on the higher levels, and it's much, much harder. You have to be way more careful and cautious and sensitive. Obviously, this is the controls of the good thing about the Atari 50 version is that the controls have all been mapped to analog sticks and triggers, so it gives you a certain level of control that you might not have had on previous versions. But then, yeah, so the way that Atari would go on to do this on so many of its games is that it would give you more points for playing on a harder difficulty, basically, whereas this one doesn't, as far as I could tell.
Yeah, it kind of falls down as a high score game at that right point, doesn't it? It just doesn't work. And the way to get more fuel, of course, that we didn't just mention, is you stick another quarter in or another 10 or 20p and Bob's your uncle, you're off again. And
so I hadn't even really attempted. I was just kind of, I'd kind of forgotten about the difficulty thing. And I was, you know, training difficulty I found it fairly comfortable to set down. The abort button is your friend in terms of resetting. But obviously it eats up fuel and basically means that subsequent runs are off the table. But I did decide to go for the hardest level command landing earlier, just to see if I could do it. And I managed a couple. And then Tony said, oh yeah, that's easy. But
I didn't mean it like that.
No, I know, I'm joking. But that was like, okay, that's fine. I can do that. That means I've completed the game as far as I'm concerned. I got us down onto the moon and therefore I won.
Yeah, I mean, to continue that kind of headspace of where we are with it, and that's roughly the same experience I had, which is, I was like, I'm trying to think of a more simpler game that sans a text adventure maybe, but even then they can be more complex, but I'm trying to think of a more simpler game I would have played for Kane and Rince. It's just one screen, a really, really simple control system. The rule set is as basic as it really comes, so... But
the complexity is all in the physics, isn't it?
Yeah, weirdly, like I initially said, I'm like, how are we meant to record a show on this? I know that's just a silly thing because, here we are.
How many times?
50 minutes into recording and,
Also, we've got a whole lot of games to talk about.
Now.
But I did find myself, I wouldn't say like addicted to it, but I found myself wanting to improve either not necessarily my score, but my ability to land at the higher difficulty levels. Not because there's any more score to it, just because it's like, okay, well, I can do it on training, of course, that's fine. But time you get it, is it Command? Is that the top one? Command one, where you do a little bit of throttle and your ship essentially does like a 360 turn in the middle of the air, and you're trying to like, go left, no, go right. And it's so simple, but there is something...
It's very sensitive.
Yeah, there is something... I'm saying more than try to simple, but it's just something so gamey about that. Like, it's just the very essence of what games are. Like, the rule set is so easy to understand, and yet it can be so complex just to get this tiny little ship-looking thing landed on the ground.
I think a really successful touchdown is inherently satisfying. Yeah.
So, although I wouldn't sit here and go, oh my god, absolutely amazing, I do think where the time and place it came out, and even in this many years later, it's actually still holds up, and it's really quite fun to actually play. It's got no longevity to it. I mean, I've played it more than I probably would have played it just browsing through the games because it's interesting for the show, and probably for that I've probably given it a 2 or 3 hours more than I probably would have done just coming across a collection.
You can go on to Gravatar next and you've got a whole game in there, which is based around the same concept.
But it sounds like most of us had that experience. Mm.
Mm. Yeah, after all we said about it, it's certainly one of those games that if you played it, you play one or two, quarters or, lives worth of this game, and you get it.
Yep.
You know what I mean? You know if you like it, if you don't. For me, it was never about, at least going back to it for this recording, it was never about... the high score. I was always just trying to land with the lowest amount of fuel expended possible. That was like my own personal game that I was playing.
Well, that's it.
Which then gets to the score, which then feeds everything else. But like, I was never concerned about like the landing pads, more concerned about like, how far can I just fall before I can use any of this thruster? Mm. Like Tony said, it's incredibly simple. And if you go back to it now, and play it on Atari 50, it's definitely one of those games that, you know, you'll look at the cabinet art, you'll play it a couple times, be like, oh, that's pretty neat, and you'll probably move on for it and won't think about it much again. It's just, yeah. It's kind of the implications of what came mm-hmm. from Lunar Lander and kind of those styles of games and, you know, the building blocks that it always built on. It's a fascinating look back at its absolute, you know, least, and at its most, it's can be, you know, you can challenge yourself on those harder difficulties and see how good you can get. I am pretty bad at this video game, but I sure played a lot of it, but I never could quite dial it in.
Well, once it starts, it's one of those games, or like all these inertia and thrust-based games, where you can see it going wrong, and you kind of, even though you're still in control to an extent, you still feel powerless to undo it.
More than one occasion the last few nights, my wife has come out into the living room, like, worried, because she just hears me going, oh, no, like what got spilled? What are you thinking? Like, oh, no, I just, you know, sorry, I just made another 2-mile crater on the lunar surface.
Isn't its rule set that you have to have less than 15... inertia going downwards? I believe I'd read that.
You get graded below 15 is safe, but then below 5 is higher score, trip. I think.
So yeah. So if you hit 16, you've plummeted into the moon surface and you get randomly 5 points.
Yeah, you get 5 points.
Which I kind of like. It's for having played. Yeah, well done.
Consolation. I was going to say, actually, this is the one area in which the game isn't dry, I suppose, is that it does give you some wryly amusing messages when you crash. I don't know if they were in the original. Yeah. Were they in the original text version? I don't know.
No, I don't think so. Certainly not the version I didn't manage. Full confession here. I didn't even manage to land the lander in the text version. I smashed several to pieces and I did get trolled.
Yeah, yeah. So it says, it will say, like, you left a 2-mile crater or you destroyed a whatever megabucks lander, or it doesn't there's nothing sort of too morbid in it. I
really like that one where if you land it, so you manage to land it, but it's a hard land, and it says hard landing, that's a one-way trip or
that's
like that. I just picture these astronauts just sitting there thinking, well, we're not going anywhere now.
Harsh. They could have made a whole movie about the next mission, which was the rescue mission. So there's no related achievements or trophies on Atari 50, sadly, but I did find that there are a couple on the Atari Flashbacks compilations, Volume 1 versions, and Atari Vault on Steam. You can win an achievement called They Named a Crater After Me, which is hitting the ground with at least 550 downward velocity, which is slightly more challenging than it sounds, because you really have to start at the very top and gun it. Yeah. But I do have that achievement. But even harder, might I suggest, is to get the maximum landing score on command mission, which is 800 points. I'm not sure what the completion ratio for that achievement is, but I'm going to say low.
And just talking about the gameplay a little bit, and talking about I really like the fact that you just talked about the zoom in screen as it being the first, because I think that's a brilliant piece of history. But also in actual gameplay terms, it can be a little iffy, because sometimes the bit when you're coming down actually to try to land, and you can see this landing zone roughly where you are, the zoom in screen will happen, but it will cut off the area that you had in your peripheral vision, and suddenly just give you a landscape, and you're trying to work out how close was that the landing point to this landscape. And quite often, by the time that the screen's got towards the area that you're after, you're either carrying too much velocity or you're at the wrong angle, and it's a right tricky. It can be a real time you can go from this will be a perfect landing to this is a complete disaster, and I might as well just crash into the mountain in a very short space of time.
That's true.
So where,
I guess knowing the landscape, which never changes over time, just playing it over and over again will help.
But I feel in a modern version of that, obviously, I think the screen would probably pan just a little bit more with the direction that you're traveling, rather than just being a vertical slice. I mean, small issue, but...
No, it's definitely worth mentioning. It's a cool effect, but it's not always helpful.
No.
We got a really nice post from old friend Andrew Elmore from our forum, who says, I have a strong emotional connection to Lunar Lander, and I'm not even sure that I could tell you why. I played it in various emulation collections as a kid and countless clones, I'm sure, but it's the arcade cabinet that I'm particularly drawn to. One day, in the earlier part of the previous decade, I walked into my local arcade, that's Dorky's in Tacoma for the curious, same place I wrote ass on the top of the scoreboard for the Asteroids issue, and they'd acquired another new old machine. Part of why I love that particular arcade is their dedication to collecting and maintaining a wealth of machines going back to the 70s. Anyhow, this time they'd acquired a classic Lunar Lander machine. The vibrant marquee art drew me in immediately. I was familiar with the game already, but something about seeing it right there in front of me with its freshly recapped eye-searing vector monitor and big chunky lever controller was simply too cool to ignore. I find great compulsion in recreating media experiences of the past, whether I live through them or not. Currently, the room in my home that houses all of my retro games and the like is also set up like a tiny home theatre, circa 2006. Once, a close friend was renting a room in a house carpeted by old orange and green shag from back in the day, so we leaned into it and furnished it appropriately with wood-panelled electronics and a plaid couch. The works! Playing Lunar Lander on an original machine in such beautiful shape, I couldn't help but imagine what it must have been like to have encountered this at the time. A decade after the moon landing, and just on the cusp of all the wild globe-altering escapades the 80s and their space races would bring. I can see it now, the chain-smoking parent telling their child to learn the game well, because by the 21st century we'll all be landing spacecraft on moon bases instead of pulling Buicks into our driveways. If that isn't a prime example of C.S. Lewis' concept of chronological snobbery, then I don't know what is. As for the game itself, I appreciate that Lunar Lander is quite difficult from the jump, urging you to be conscious about your application of fuel burn while tempting you with those fiendish little 5x multipliers. There's a surprising range of analog control on that lever that feels good in hand. There's room for subtlety in the range of the lever's sweep that you don't necessarily get from trigger controls in something like Atari 50, though that's still the best home conversion of the game that I've encountered by miles. There are other games that have utilized a version of Lunar Lander's core mechanic as a mechanism for movement and exploration. Rare's Solar Jetman comes to mind, but those games don't tend to work for me the way this one does, if only because Lunar Lander places so much emphasis on the careful execution of that movement, spotlighting the simulated physics as they relate to the player's fine motor control adjustments. It's simple, clean, technical, and mean. Every time I go to Dorky's, Lunar Lander is the first and last game I play. I can't imagine it's been a big earner as a coin-op in the modern day, especially when they wedged it in between an NBA Jam machine and a row of pinball tables for a while there, but I'll be more than happy to spend some time with that cabinet every chance I get. Lovely stuff, Andrew. Thank you so much for sharing. You been to Dorky's, Brian?
Nah, that's on the other side of the country.
A long way away.
Yeah, that's I am approximately only a 34-hour drive from Dorky's.
Yeah, yeah.
It's America. It's all the same thing. You just get from there. Like,
that's true. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
That's like us.
That makes, see you there tomorrow, Brian. Yeah.
I mean, it makes my 4 hours to get to Bury seem reasonable.
Yeah. I should say that the distance I am for those other two arcades is no small trip. It's about 9 hours, but at least something that you can.
It's like us going to Scotland
with a group of friends in the car. It goes by pretty quick.
So yeah, we mentioned the legacy, and I think it really started in earnest. Obviously, Asteroids plays a huge part, and probably more games than we can name check here. But I think relevant is Gravatar, which was very much a similar concept to Lunar Lander, but way more gamey, with a little shooty gun and gun turrets and refueling on the fly. This came out in 1982, and various, I think it was that game really that inspired the many, many clones. Solar Jetman was mentioned there, but those of a certain age and people who had home computers in the 80s will remember the likes of Thrust by Firebird and Oids, and Zara Thruster on the Amiga, Fly Harder, Subterranea on the Mega Drive. And then way more recently, we've had things like Pixel Junk Shooter, that series of games, which are very much based on the Gravatar concept. Gravity Crash on the PS3. There's a PSP version of that, which is part of PS Plus, which looks a little rough, but I think plays a fun game. And then very recently, we've had, as part of Atari's updated series, we've had Gravatar Recharged. We very recently had Lunar Lander Beyond, which I think you've had a go at, Chris?
Yeah, I've actually spent a few hours on it now. So I picked that up and I've been playing that on the Steam Deck, and that is good fun.
Cool.
So that is a reimagined version of the game. It's not a game that's it's almost like if Lunar Lander would have been created from scratch today, this is what it would have been.
Yeah.
So it kind of plays half of the game's like a visual novel, which is okay. it's all right. You got a very weird cocaine snorting scientist, which is really odd for
an odd choice.
Company like Atari. It's really, there's some questionable stuff in there. And then
like
you've
Atari
got the
back in its heyday, to be honest.
Well, yeah. It's like they've regressed back to the late 70s. But then you've got the gameplay and it's really solid. It is Lunar Lander with things like mazes, and you have to go and rescue certain scientists. So there's elements of Lunar Rescue come in again. I've spent about 3 or 4 hours, and I think I'm about 70% of the way through the campaign. It introduces new landers that do things slightly different.
Yeah.
The problem with the game is that fundamentally it is a one-trick pony.
Yeah.
And it's only fun for a little while. So the more, they can stick different narrative conceits around these missions.
Yeah.
And they can give you a different environment to land in. You are doing the same thing every level, and that is you've got a certain amount of time to plonk your lander down on a surface, and then it's mission over. And whilst that is pretty playable, and it's very well done, and it looks nice, and it's nice music, and there's really nice pixel graphics, it's got a finite amount of time before it starts to get, I need a little bit more to the game.
Right.
But it's £25 release. I've just looked now on, so it's £25 for the Switch. And I think it's worth a few hours of anyone's time at that almost budget price. I think it's quite playable.
Yep. Open Critic has a 74 average from 19 reviews on all current gen systems, if you're curious. But yes, I think it's probably fair to say that, like, in terms of atmosphere, it doesn't really have the same kind of vibe as the original?
No, completely, no. Completely different. Yeah, they've got this synthy music playing in the background, which feels, I think I would rather have a little bit more space and silence, actually, in my Lunar Lander gameplay.
You need Lunar Lander Redux out tomorrow, which may or may not be any good. The other one I wanted to ask you about, though, Chris, was, I don't know if you've played it, but it was such a good thought you had. Like, has anyone done a version of Lunar Lander, but for the Playdate?
Well, yes, they have.
So, do you use the crank handle?
You use the crank.
Perfect.
And it works really, really well. So I managed to pick it up.
Oh, nice.
I was sitting there, was it yesterday? We were chatting on Slack.
Yeah,
the day before. Idea. Wouldn't that work really well?
Yeah.
Jeez. Of course there is a Lunar Lander clone for the Playdate.
Gravity Express is the name.
Gravity Express. And it's really quite good. So this takes... So this, I think, came before Lunar Lander Beyond. It's more of a... So it's like Lunar Lander Beyond without the story. So each level is... Again, it introduces maze elements. There's different kinds of ships. You've got slightly kind of different objectives. But fundamentally, you're landing the thing on the platform. But the one thing that makes this game absolutely stand out from probably every other port and clone is that it's and there is an option not to do this, but if you play it using the default control method, you play it using the little crank.
Of course you
actually
do.
It gives it a really tactile feel, very dissimilar to the original arcade, but it's probably the only version since then that gives you that same kind of tactile feel. Relationship to the actual lander.
I assume you're going to have to wind faster then to get more thrust.
No, so you the crank controls the direction of the ship, and there's a digital button
that
you press.
That's a fundamental change, but that does make sense. Yeah, because it would be too much winding otherwise.
Yeah, you might snap your crank.
Yeah.
Classic.
Looking at it, playing it reminds me very much of Gravity Force and Gravity Power on the Amiga.
Yeah,
which were probably the influences for it. And actually, taking this back to Gravatar, which was the first one I mentioned, I literally just learned that the development name for Gravatar was Lunar Battle, very much betraying its roots as a lunar lander sequel. Any others we should mention before we move on to our other featured game?
No, the one thing I think Chris did mention was about the kind of the sound, but I don't think we actually kind of addressed that there is no music or anything in Lunar Lander.
No.
It is as basic as basic is. And
yeah. There's about three noises.
Yeah.
A beep, a bang, and a thrust.
And
that's it.
And the low fuel alarm.
And it's,
yeah, that's the beep.
It's quite weird to play a game like that today. Like, it's amazing that you just get so used to every game having, you know, its own soundscape. But it's just... Like when the low fuel alarm goes off and it's at a very, very high pitched decibel.
Piercing.
Yeah, panic.
It doesn't necessarily oh my God. But there is that element of like, okay, yeah, I know, I'm getting close.
It feels authentic and it feels like an alarm rather than just an indicator.
Yeah, and I know you said earlier in the show as well, like the thrush sound, it's for its time, it's a decent enough sound. It conveys exactly what it needs to do. I just, when I first powered it up, it was a little jarring just to have silence between like these long parts of like just letting the ship drift.
Yeah.
Thrust.
It's almost restful if it wasn't so stressful.
Yeah, no, just that wanted to highlight that. It's just, it's odd to play a game in 2024 where, you know, there's very little, indication of what you're doing other than just the moment. And I suppose the indication of what you're doing is the thrust and low fuel, and that's good enough. Yeah. But yeah, and the
be brave for a modern game to be quiet.
Yeah, but then the completion when you land of the nice little ditty. Like, yeah, cool.
Is there a ditty?
I can't remember. Maybe I'm getting confused.
I don't think so. I think you've imagined that. Maybe. You've made that up
Lunar
Rescue.
Maybe it's Lunar Rescue, the last one I played, where it's like...
there you go. That's separate.
Well, they're kind of... Well, we've played them back to back, so there we go. But yeah, so that's... For me, that was a weird, jarring thing, but actually kind of cool when I think back on it.
Well, obviously, we'll wrap up our feelings on Lunar Lander towards the end of the podcast, but now let's move on to our other featured title, which is Taito's Lunar Rescue, made for the 8080 system in 1979, developed and published by Taito. I used to say Taito, and then I taught myself it was incorrect. Now I've started saying it again for some reason. Taito. Designed, as far as I can establish, by Tomohiro Nishikado, the creator of Space Invaders, and it's the same hardware and tech, but there's no actual credits on the game. But this was based on an interview that I read with somebody else from Taito who said that they'd asked Nishikado-san something about the game, so that doesn't take Sherlock Holmes to work out that presumably that means if he wasn't the director designer, then he was very close to it. But I suspect he probably was. If anybody else out there knows that there was actually another unnamed, uncredited Taito developer behind Lunar Rescue, then please let us know. But I couldn't find evidence on the internet. Game was released after Lunar Lander came out, hence we're covering it second. Also alphabetical order, came out in November 1979 in Japan and didn't arrive in the US until May 1980. It was also released separately via Universal Co. Limited as Galaxy Rescue to the arcades in 1980. There's only been a few home versions of this, although it is or has been available on the AntStream Arcade streaming service. It was part of Taito Legends 2, which was, a compilation back in the PS2 Xbox generation, also a PC version from Empire. Then it was much more recently a part of the Space Invaders Invincible collection, but only if you bought the Special Edition or Worldwide Edition exclusive. It was on that compilation from Taito. That was released 2020 or 2021, depending on where you were. And it's also included as part of the stock list of games on the Taito Egret 2 mini console. That came out in 2022. My first memory of this game is playing it at the fair. So the fair comes to the Level Park at Brighton, as it's known, and has done since before I was born, I think, certainly. As far back as I can remember, and it still does, whether it's the same family or company running the fair, but it's a proper, you know, old school traveling fairground of amusements. But back in the 80s, as well as all the rides and booths and stalls, they also had some arcade rooms because arcades were hot in the early 80s. And I remember my mum taking me down there one summer's day in, yeah, it would have been probably 81 or 82, something like that. So it wouldn't have been brand new. But what I didn't know was, so obviously I was familiar with Space Invaders by this point. There was a cabinet which said Space Invaders Part 2 all over it. What I didn't know at this point was that Space Invaders Part 2 was essentially Space Invaders 1, but in colour and with a slightly faster processor and all the stuff that we talked about on our Space Invaders show. So as far as I was concerned, I was playing Space Invaders Part 2. But it seemed really different and weird and interesting and complicated. And I remember running over to mum and saying, I'm playing Space Invaders 2. And you have to rescue these guys, and then you fly back up. And anyway, it turns out I should have waited for it to show the title screen. It would have said Lunar Rescue, or possibly the other thing, Galaxy, whatever it was, Galaxy Rescue. But anyway, I didn't know for years until I learned more about Space Invaders Part 2 that what I'd been playing was something completely different. And yeah, and I didn't actually have a copy to play until the Space Invaders Invincible Collection and the Taito Egret 2 Mini just recently. Brian, had you ever come across this one before? I think you've also got to play this on a cab.
Yeah, but just recently. I until researching for the show, would have told you that it was connected to Lunar Lander, like just based on naming convention, you know
yeah,
what I mean?
But no.
But I was, you know... And there is a landing component of this game, too. So when I played it for the first time, must have been, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. I had never seen it and had never heard of it before. Played it in the arcade version. And then in preparation for the show, I saw that it was part of that collection, the Space Invaders one. You can still get that Invincible collection, the special edition, on Switch, but it is still a full $60 American. So I may have opted for some more devious means to play it some more.
Understand.
But I've been playing it, and one of my friends who goes on this trip with me has a nice little kind of countertop emulation setup that had Lunar Rescue on it. So I was playing that quite a bit last weekend in prep for this.
Nice. Chris, any previous encounters of the close
yeah,
kind?
I played the cab at Revival. Retro Revival, which is a retro gaming like an expo that has just been on this past weekend, which I didn't go, but I played it at one of those probably about 6 or 7 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I could have sworn, if you'd have said to me Lunar Rescue, I'd said, oh yeah, I love playing that on the Spectrum.
Yeah,
but I didn't love playing it on the Spectrum because the original Spectrum port of this game is absolutely horrible.
Yeah.
And the game I can remember playing when I was a kid was really, really good. Now, that's either some kind of weird false memory, or it's a memory of a clone, or it's a completely different game. But when I actually downloaded the Spectrum port and had a go, and it really is horrible. But there is a Lunar Rescue deep in my past. I feel it's probably called something different, and it's a clone. Yeah.
Right,
I first played the arcade game a few years ago, and I really like it as far as it goes. But that we can talk about that later. But yeah,
that's okay.
It's a game that I have been back to on a few occasions since I first played it, and it's good fun.
Nice, Tony. Any history?
Unlike Lunar Lander, I had never seen Lunar Rescue in my entire life. No. Just yeah,
but you had put yourself down as an amber.
Yeah, because I was willing to play it. So you know,
because you're curious. Yeah.
Lunar curious.
That doesn't mean anything to listeners. Tony said he was interested to play it, which is why he's here. Yeah.
No, absolutely. But it's just once again, I love filling in those gaps of history that you haven't experienced, and it's one of those one of those games. So I came into it completely fresh. In fact, I looked around, I thinking, well, where do I know I've been told where to play it, but I ended up settling on Antstream. Seemed to be the easiest location.
Still there, is it?
Right. Still there, $3.99 for a month's trial. So I was like,
oh, okay.
That's it.
Yeah.
Because I did look at the Space Invaders Invincible Collection. It's like, yeah, it was like £60. I was like, wow, that's Heritage value. So, ironically, I could have played, I suppose, Lunar Lander on Ant Dream as well, but you know, that's not where I started. So, but the
definitely better to play that one on Atari 50.
Yeah, I mean, once again, it's such a simple game that, you know, something like this Ant Stream, it worked perfectly fine.
Yeah, I think it's fine. Especially Ant Stream is particularly good for single screen stuff because the streaming tends to show up when things are moving around too much.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's where I played it. So yeah, no real history of it other than I do like Chris's story where you kind of you put games into machines that maybe they never even released on sometimes.
Yes.
It's just like, I'm sure I played it on Amstrad and it was actually on the Amiga and vice versa. So
there's so many dirty clones back in the 80s that you just never know.
Is that Mandela syndrome where you create false memories? I think that's right.
I think we've all got them, haven't we?
Just need a good defrag. But although that's probably a memory that we've been jettisoned. But so really, really fresh and new to it, but obviously just playing it directly after playing Lunar Lander, there is some...
Very different. Similarly simple.
But there is a line of dialogue that, you know, that runs through those two games, so I was more than happy to jump in on that and give it a go.
Moby Games describes Lunar Rescue as an arcade game where the player has to evacuate stranded astronauts from the moon. So earlier than Defender, which has a rescuing aspect, it was a good example of a game where you were trying to do something kind of heroic, honourable, rather than purely hostile. Although this game does have shooting in it on the way back up. Our old friend of the show, Ashley Day, who has his blog, Games from the Black Hole, did a piece on this. One of the things he noted was that the flyer for the arcade machine basically takes photos from Stanley Kubrick's 2001: A Space Odyssey to sell the game. Again, who knows if they paid for those or whatever? But there they are.
It was just a Wild West of copyright infringement, wasn't it? It just so much fun. Yeah. You could get away with so much more cool stuff back then. At least, like pirate wise, not like corporation wise. But yeah, just so much fun.
So. Unlike Lunar Lander, this is there are two key ways in which the presentation is different. One is the monitor is mounted vertically, which is why I like playing it on both my Switch and on the Egret 2 Mini, because you can play it invert. And it's a raster screen. It is not vectors. This is graphics. And actually, even though that original Spectrum port was, famously not very good, if you were going to come to this game now and you were familiar with Spectrum graphics, you would probably say it looks a bit like a Spectrum game.
Yeah, exactly. How did they get it so wrong?
Somebody has since got it so right,
corrected,
haven't they?
The aberration.
Yeah, there's a new version from the last 5 years or so, which is maybe even more recently than that.
Yeah, 22. It was last year. It's really good.
Lunar Rescue RX for the Spectrum, which is nigh on arcade perfect.
Yeah.
Even probably right down to the color channels. So another interesting thing about this is, again, the early days of color gaming, multicolor gaming. So the screen is, certainly once you get above the ground, which has a sort of green bottom, and then you've got these landing pads, which have multiple strips of color. But then above that, the screen is divided into bars, basically, so as your ship flies up the screen, it goes through different colours on the way up, but through red, yellow, blue, and green, I think. It is weird. But, you know, again, for the time, we were still, I guess this was when developers were starting to push multicolour gaming. So Galaxian came out the same year, another game that we've previously covered, and I think they had Namco at this point, for whatever reason, had pushed the tech a little bit further than Taito had. So I would say, from my point of view, even though I thought it was really cool and full of character and life when I first played it in the early 80s, it's a pretty simplistic looking game.
Yeah, it is a simplistic looking game. It is. And some of the sprite work on the ships are questionable. It definitely is a simple looking game, but I don't know, is it just my age? Am I just an old romantic that I actually look at this now and think, oh, I love this. I love the the charm. I love the way your ship changes colour. In fact, it even took me a little while to even notice that. I don't know. Am I just an old romantic fool?
I don't think you are. I also like the look of it for similar reasons. There's some part of me that like that looks at those landing pads and are just like, why aren't they symmetrical? Like, there's a little like it feels like they should just be trapezoiding out and forming a pyramid.
Because they're
right?
rocky they outcroppings, Brian.
You know all those inverted pyramids on the lunar surface, but
they need a bit of airbrushing, don't they?
There's something charm to it. It's instantly readable for sure, as you know what it is.
There's no doubt about what you have to do as soon as you look at it.
Right. Yeah. No, like you said, simplistic, but I don't think the visuals like most of these older games, obviously, but like the visuals didn't detract from the experience actually playing it. It was readable, and I knew what I had to do, so I guess it got the job done. But it's certainly nothing. You don't look at this game and go, "Wow!" like you would have at some other games. It's just like it looks like an arcade game of its time.
What I will say, funny thing is coming not knowing anything about the game, listening to people talk about it on our Slack channel. Chris in particular talking about people dying, and I was like, it sounds really odd, like how you go from what Luna landed to this. But just jumping into it for the first time, my first impression was like, oh, did I accidentally fire up Space Invaders? Like just like my absolutely first head brain thing is like, this is Space Invaders. And obviously very quickly you realize there's some similarities, but it's not. But just to have that, it's like, okay, well, it feels like it's taken a big chunk of something from somewhere and kind of amalgamated these.
Same tech, same designer.
Just amalgamated all these different like aspects of multiple games into this one thing. Now, obviously, every game could be probably accused of doing that for the longest of time, but it was funny having that first blush of like, wow, that really does look like Space Invaders from a kind of an odd angle.
I think, as I say, playing this whenever it was, 81, 82, I can't be sure. I was a little kid. I was immediately struck even then, though, by how much pacier and more involved it was than Space Invaders, which was only a year before this, remember?
Yeah, the scheme moves a lot. Like, there's a lot moving at once, and not everything's moving in a rhythm like Space Invaders, and the different tactics and the way that the way that your obstacles change from landing to then climbing is interesting too. It really feels like there is some, not that there's not strategy to Lunar Lander, of course, but there's a little bit more strategy here of like, okay, what platform am I going to go for first, and where, how do I avoid this, and where are the most enemies? Oh, they're going to be over here, but they're coming this way. Like, there's just a lot more visual language to kind of process in order to play the game well, which to me then makes it more interesting in the long run, because it feels much more like if I only did this thing, or if that ship just would have gone that way, I could have gotten this much farther. So unlike Lunar Lander, I would say, it definitely had the just one more game feel for me.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a really good point you make, Leon. I mean, 1 year between Space Invaders and Lunar Rescue, and they feel very, very different in terms of their complexity and what they're doing. I mean, Lunar Rescue is essentially two games in one, because you've got the descent to rescue the little dudes there at the bottom. They look like they're having a brilliant time, by the way. Don't they? They don't look in distress at all. And then you've got the second part of the game, which is getting back up, which is then a more conventional Space Invader type shooter. So it feels like it's, if you think about, if you put them side by side, they're almost a quantum leap apart.
Yeah, I suppose we should, in terms of the wrinkles of the gameplay, we should talk about some of the key differences. So the main thing is that there's no unsafe landing in this outside of not hitting a landing pad altogether. So it doesn't matter what pace you land at, but
slam it down.
Slam it down. But then that, and it actually gives you some kind of auto retro thrusters as you come in, kind of thing. But the narrower the platform, the more points you get. But ultimately, you're going to need to land repeatedly to get the happy little guys. I think they're, rather than celebrating a goal or something, they're actually waving their arms about in distress, Chris. But they're so cute. So on the way down, you have a fuel counter. On the way back up, you don't.
It's so weird.
Which is, It is so weird.
It took me the longest of time to work that out. I was like, well, why am I not burning any fuel? I mean, like, literally now using boosters to get up. Like,
shall we talk about this now? Because it is a thing. So this was actually where I found out about Nishikado being the designer of the game, because it was Yuichi Toyama of Taito talking to VG Charts in 2020. Who says, first of all, Lunar Rescue is not a true part of the Space Invaders series, but the invaders are depicted on the demo screen. So perhaps the game shows another battle that was happening on the moon while the Earth was being attacked by the invaders.
Maybe.
By the way,
it
all happened. By the way, the fuel is an important element in the game of Lunar Rescue. When you use reverse thrusting during your descent towards the lunar surface, you burn fuel, but not when traveling back to dock. Common sense dictates this should burn more fuel, if anything. But when I asked Mr. Nishikado about this, all he could say was, come to think of it, you're right. There must be a dedicated fuel tank for ascending.
There must be.
Old games are just wonderful. For those, but you imagine now, somebody asking... asking somebody from I can't even think of the developer now.
It sounds like a Peter Molyneux answer, though, doesn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah, must be.
In Shadow of the Colossus, I noticed that when he's running towards Mono at the end of the game, that she seems like her finger wiggles, but then back then this guy's just like, oh yeah, you're right. I don't know, we didn't think about it. There's dedicated fuel. Yeah, that's it. Solar power. Yeah.
Also,
it's
this
fight
was
me, you say.
41 yeah. years after he made the game, somebody goes, by the way. Why don't you use fuel when taking off? Oh, separate fuel tank.
That's awesome.
Update it. Yeah.
Brilliant.
So the audio is worthy of mention, because if you have played Space Invaders, it's going to sound quite familiar. That was one area that they didn't change a lot about. I mean, it doesn't have the thrumming, throbbing, menacing rhythmic alien descent, but it does have similar shooting effects and explosion effects and so on and so forth.
I wonder if that was just a convenience of already having the work done,
probably
right? Like, that would be no way to really know without talking.
We've made a good laser sound, a really good laser sound that people love, and a good explosion sound. Let's use them. We want to get this game
out. It
works
for Star Wars. They're still doing it. So
yeah, exactly.
I'm going to make a bit of a half-baked point here.
Cool.
And the reason it's half-baked is because it's very technical and I don't really understand it. But I was listening to the wonderful Tenpence Arcade podcast on their episode on Lunar Rescue. And they are they're much more techie than I am when it comes to this stuff. But what they were saying is the sound of the actual cab is a lot different to the sound that is emulated within MAME. And therefore, I assume the other home ports that we would have played, or the home versions, the emulated versions of the arcade game, because something to do with the logic board on the actual arcade machine worked in such a way that they couldn't emulate that in MAME. So what they did in MAME was they used the Space Invader samples.
Okay.
Oh, maybe that's it.
Yeah, that would make sense then. So it might
that little ditty that you get when you... land, that is not in the original cab. I am led to believe. Now, I cannot verify that is the case. I can't remember.
That's not so much a half-baked point as a really interesting bit of knowledge and trivia that I wasn't aware of. Obviously, again, going back 40 years to when I played the arcade machine of this, I can't remember what it sounded like. So I couldn't tell you.
No, I can't remember either. But if anybody does have a cab accessible, it'd be interesting to compare the two.
I'm writing this down because we're going back to Galloping Ghost in September.
Yeah, try it.
So I'll see. I'll if I remember,
field
please try to remind
please.
Me.
I feel like you need to let listeners know 40 years later, just to,
And then we can ask Mr. Toyama-san about it, and he'll probably smack us in the face.
He'll go,
you're right.
One mini extension of that point is I played this on the Mister, which is FPGA, on a dedicated Lunar Rescue core. So that makes me wonder, given that simulation rather than emulation, was I getting the true sound or was I getting the not true sound, But then I had the ditties. Oh, yeah. So I don't know. But if anybody can verify, I'd be really interested to know and see a side-by-side comparison.
Interesting.
That is interesting. Yeah. I mean, Taito also is a slightly separate issue, but they've got some history for binning stuff off, like assets and stuff that they didn't think they'd ever need anymore.
Yeah.
Much like the BBC archives, which has come back to bite them a bit in recent times. But inroads are being made. So the game starts with the player being positioned in a mothership that moves back and forth across the top of the screen, a bit like the famous flying saucer in Space Invaders, only bigger and friendly. At the bottom are three platforms located on the surface of the moon, and in between are asteroids that move horizontally across the screen. Don't question it. With the press of a button, the player's rescue ship is dropped from the mothership, and from there the player has to steer left and right to avoid colliding with asteroids and successfully land on a platform. To slow the descent, thrust can be used, but it uses fuel which is only available in a limited supply. Once landed, one of the six astronauts will board the ship. Once the ship has been boarded by an astronaut, it's time to take off and return to the mothership. The asteroids are then replaced by flying saucers, which attempt to stop the player's ascent. The player then has to avoid crashing into them or the bombs that they drop. To help, he has a gun to shoot them with. Your spaceship has a missile launcher type of thing. Once getting through the swarm of saucers, the player has to dock with the mothership. If the bay opening of it is missed, the ship will explode and the astronaut will fall back down to the surface and die. When all six astronauts have been rescued or killed, the game moves on to the next level. The thing that strikes me about this game, as it did when I played it back in the day, in an era when games could last seconds and were famously often punishing, especially at the arcades, Lunar Rescue is pretty friendly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it starts off that way.
Yeah, it starts off. You can get a decent go out of it for your 10p, which is probably why I scampered over to my mum saying, this game's really fun. Can I have another 10p? Because stuff like the docking is pretty generous. The landing is pretty generous and forgiving. Yeah.
Yeah, not so much on the later Spectrum port, which tightens that up, but I agree, although once you get... I don't know how far you guys managed to get. I managed to get to the fourth frame. Ooh. After the little cutscene that you get.
Oh, wow. I think I maybe got there once yesterday. But yeah, that's pretty far.
No, does it have intermissions then? I haven't even seen it.
So you get this little cutscene where the Space Invaders from the title screen, they say something like, we now fight or fight or something like that. And then... It really does, the difficulty then really does ramp up, and the ships are really fast and they spit out loads of bombs and
meteors flying in.
Lots of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
It gets really difficult.
As you'd expect, especially four boards in. But you can, I think most people will, just starting off on the default settings, you'll probably rescue two or three people at least before you lose a life. You know, maybe not, but judging the ascent is, I would say, probably the most challenging for a new player, because you've got the stuff both scrolling backwards and forwards and occasionally spitting fire at you.
The projectiles feel very Galaga to me, in the sense that obviously Galaga is a much faster game, but the way that you think that you're just about safe to be past a ship, and then at the last second that projectile comes through, like, it can get pretty devious coming back up through those ranks, to the point where, like, I remember, I kind of white knuckled my way on my last life up through and barely got past a couple projectiles. Then, of course, promptly, you know, biffed it on my ship's bay door, and then the astronaut falls to his doom. It can be kind of like in that way where, like, you just when you think you're safe, this game will kind of pitch that last projectile at you that might get you, you know, it to the player's mind kind of out of nowhere.
Yeah, I think I had that kind of same feeling as well. Actually, descenting seemed to be a bit more like in my control, just working out the pace of asteroids moving across as and where. Like, is there a big enough gap there? Do I need to drop faster? I never really found that too challenging, although. Even the fuel aspect, I wasn't even really that conscious on that because I didn't tend to run out of fuel too much.
Not like Luna.
No, completely the opposite. Luna.
Yeah.
But the ascending back up, there was a stiffness to the controls that occasionally where I was like, okay, I know that there's a, you know, a what do you call it, a bomb missile coming down, and I should have plenty of time to you know, evade that and then just get caught in its trajectory somehow and just be like, oh, that's frustrating. And even like moving up with the boost, it didn't feel quite like instantaneous, like, okay, I need a boost now. There is a little bit of weird inertia that goes on there. And occasionally I would not quite get that correct. But there was a couple of times elements of like, there's this tiny gap. Like as you get, I think I was on screen three, like you have a real kind of like what felt like a pixel perfect gap between either descending or traveling back through. And when you put it off, it does have that kind of like, yes, got through, like, awesome. And yeah, I was completely unaware about the catch in the side. Like nine times out of 10, well, I say 10 times out of 10, I'd always land back into ship perfectly fine. And then I was completely caught off guard by just catching the side of the ship and losing a guy diving out. I was like, really? Like, what? Like, that's, and even a couple of times.
But you don't lose a life. That's really weird. Like, one of the men will fall and die, so you can't get the end of level bonus, but you don't lose a life. It's so
again,
weird.
Uncommonly friendly and generous for a game of its type and era.
And always, I'm not. Did it give you life back for getting any higher score?
So 3,000. Once you get to 3,000,
so that was
the
ditty I heard, and that was the case. So a bit more, certainly a hell of a lot more gamey than something like Lunar Lander. Fun. What's still fun?
Maybe you guys can explain to me. Maybe I learned it and then forgot to write it down or whatever. Is there a bonus you get for the amount of fuel you have remaining, or is that fuel an arbitrary number?
No, it gets added to your score at the end.
Okay,
of
that's
the,
what I thought.
At the
okay,
end of the level,
so more
of
a score, but chasing. No bonus. Like, yeah, okay, yep. That's what I, because it was one of those things that, like, maybe the third or fourth time playing it last weekend, I was like, do I need to worry about that number at all? Like, is this just like a red herring that's distracting me? And because as it's already, people have already mentioned, like, it's kind of difficult. I found it difficult to run out of fuel. Never a concern for me.
On the later levels, I think you can and will. You can still play it if you run out of fuel. You just can't use the boost to help you dodge.
Okay, that makes sense. Yep.
Yeah, no plummeting into the surface. So yeah, it's a lot less. Although there's more enemies, more things out to get you, the game is considerably less kind of cruel and just harsh than Lunar Lander. As I say, really, there's not much relationship between the games other than some thematic concepts and the fact they both came out in 1979. One's American, one's Japanese, one's a kind of pseudo-simulation, one of them's basically a space shoot-em-up, albeit an early one.
But I think there are some examples of this lacking a bit of polish that you come to expect from Space Invaders and later Taito games. I think some of the hit detection can be a bit wonky at times, and there are times when bullets seem to pass through both your ship in your favour and against you, and there was a few times I died and I thought, I'm not sure that...
Hitbox shenanigans.
Absolutely.
I think there's definitely... there is some wonkiness, I think, to the hit detection, which I think fast forward 2 or 3 years, you wouldn't have seen that from a Taito game.
Yeah, and I mean, there's not that much more to say. I wouldn't have said Tony was asking on our Slack, like, what's a good score? Chris said that
5,000
is the default. Beating the default is a good start. Yes,
that's a good start. Yeah,
but then I was looking at records, former world records, and 300,000+ with no lives lost until 100,000+.
That's what I was aiming for.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's if you've got it on Antstream, then you've obviously got that. I think the Invincible Collection version has some online leaderboards, so the other 12 people like me who bought that have got that, I guess. But yes, it's just the kind of game that generally, unless it was like in a situation like this, I would stick on for a bit and have a little fun with, and probably not take too seriously.
Yeah.
Your anecdote, I think, about you playing it when you were a child, Leanne, is probably the most telling in the fact that like it does, those first couple levels do feel fair, mm-hmm. you know, for an arcade game of that era.
Yeah.
That's nope. not typical. You know, it did, no. it wasn't instantly punishing difficult, and you feel like you could have some success. And I, that is a, I use the, talking about this with my friends, we talk about first stages of games a lot and how they can draw you in. I feel like the first stage of Frogger is very similar to that. Like, you know, like most people who can control a stick can make it
yeah.
through that first stage, at least yeah. get to one of the holes, you know, so you can feel that success and feel that pull, and it gets you in and keeps you going. And that's the way I felt about this, because I handled that first stage like I would, like I was a lunar, like I was the lunar rescuer. It was me, Tom Lunar Rescue. That was me. And I was just, you know, kind of breezing through. And then as it went on and got further and became more complicated, like I the game was clearly out to kill me, but at least would let me have that fair bit of yeah. fun first, which I think is a big deal. Mm.
Alex79 from our forum says, I spent a couple of hours playing Lunar Rescue via MAME on my Vita. It was a whole lot of fun. Initially, what seems like a super basic early arcade game reveals itself to be quite tense as you weave in and out of the asteroids on your way down to collect your little man, making pixel-perfect dodges through the hazards. And then, on the way back up, you're treated to an entirely different style of game, more like Space Invaders, as you pick off the enemy ships and head back for the mothership. It became really satisfying to plot a course and shoot the way through back to the top. Of course, the game gets more difficult, and I wasn't very good at it, so I only saw 3 or 4 stages. But I enjoyed it. And the horror of crashing into the side of your base ship at the top and watching your little man fall to the ground was quite comical. I also realized that one of my favorite games of the 80s, which was Lucasfilm's Rescue on Fractalus, which used, frankly, phenomenal for the time 3D graphics, conceptually is this game, but in incredible 3D, basically. You fly down to a planet's surface, you land, you pick people up, and you fly back off to the mothership. Yeah. And I guess this is a kind of a hoary old cliche at this point, but and you know, we have all kinds of genres of game now, but I do still think that games where you help and rescue and save are still not commonplace enough, because it can be like, obviously interacting with stuff via blades and guns and lasers and whatever else is inherently satisfying and proven so, but saving and rescuing and being heroic, I think, is kind of one of the great underused mechanics of gaming.
Yeah, completely agree with that. I was thinking exactly the same thing myself, that when you look back at some of those older games, some of my favourite games in that area are games that you would rescue people, whether it be rescuing people from underwater or flying in a chopper and going to rescue people landing and picking them up and taking them back. There is something so compelling about that idea, isn't there?
Maybe the most thrilling part of even like a Robotron is trying to get around the map and save all the the men, women, and children who are walking around that map, who are just trying to get through their apparently black screen day with their
briefcases. If I say to you guys escort missions and you're all going to fall apart, so you know.
Yeah.
Different ways of handling it though, but you make a good point.
Right, yeah. Choplifter, and it, you know, there's a lot of different examples.
There's a big difference between sort of having to tiptoe through a level avoiding any detection than like setting your chopper down in Choplifter and having some dudes climb aboard, and then you still have all the same level of control and you don't have to be any more stealthy, but you're just kind of flying them.
I'm all about Crazy Taxi, just getting people from A to B. You know, that's where it is.
Well, of course, famously, the follow-up to that game was the ambulance one, which people found too distressing and stressful for it to be popular, because basically a kid, you know, you pick up a kid who's like dying and you don't get them to hospital in time. It's not quite the same as being shouted at by some skater dude for not having got to the record store in time. You've basically let some child die in the back of your ambulance. But I still approve of the concept. Maybe that wasn't quite the right manifestation of it in an arcade game where your clock is constantly running down. But maybe in a way it was perfect. I've forgotten actually what that game was called. It wasn't called Crazy Ambulance.
That would have been a great title.
Because there was Jambo Safari, that was that series, and there was the ambulance one, in which people die if you're bad at the game. And
it's called Emergency, was it?
Emergency something. Yes. Mm. Emergency something. Anyway, listener, if you're shouting at your device, I'll have probably looked it up by now, so don't worry about it. Anyway. Yeah, I was thinking of Burning Rangers recently as well, the Sonic Team game from the Saturn, yeah, which was all about the rescuing, very little combat whatsoever. And yeah. Maybe there is more of it in modern games than I'm thinking of, but as I say, it tends to be exactly what Tony said, which is rescue missions, which escort missions, which are less, tend to be less enjoyable the way they're
even in. even a game like Flicky, saving those little birds from the cats. What are you gonna do?
What was that game on? Absolutely. What was that game on PSN that was like a top-down Flicky? The Last Hero, the Last Action Hero,
That's on the Schwarzenegger, wasn't it? The Last, it's a very different thing.
Yeah. Anyway,
I'll have to look that up again. Congratulations to the listener. If you're shouting at your phone, that means that you just listen to a real podcast.
Just a visual stream of Leon's head.
It's just starting to sound like The Monthly with Leon and Jay trying to remember things.
That's true.
What I was going to say is that I know in the Slack channel we've been having, certainly Chris has been having some fun about, you know, astronauts not making it and being, you know, chastised for not actually getting there in time or be able to do the thing. Which has been making me laugh, but yeah, I didn't personally get that from the game, but it was funny seeing you guys talk about it.
They go, So I wasn't really aware, but there were some clones that I missed back in the day. CRL Group and Liversoft for the Spectrum, and Alligator for the Acorn Electron and BBC. And there are clones with different titles like Meteor Mission for the BBC and Meteor Mission 2 for the TRS-80. And there was one on the Atari 8-bit, which was my home computer of choice in the 80s. Brodebund made a game called Stellar Shuttle, which I don't think I've ever heard of until this point. Mm. But thanks to Wikipedia for telling me. Other than that, I think, yeah, we've already mentioned the only version that is possibly really of note in this day and age, which is a recent Spectrum port, Lunar Rescue RX, which was featured in Indie Retro News last year, as you say. And, looks like I mean, from a screenshot, obviously it's horizontal, but it's got a status bar down the side, so the screen space is not dissimilar, and it really does look very close.
Yeah, it's hard to pick out any differences. As I said, the only thing I could find, I've spent a bit of time playing it, was that it was less forgiving,
right,
both on the landing on the platforms, because on the arcade game you can be half on, half off, it'll let you have it, whereas on the Spectrum version it's just tightened up a little bit.
I wonder if they did that on purpose.
I think so. There was an interview with him on the Spectrum Show, which is a YouTube channel by a guy called Paul Jenkinson, which is dead interesting if you're into the modern specy scene. But there was an interview with the guy, and he said he wanted to try and fix some of the little gameplay quirks from the arcade. So there shouldn't be any hit detection issues. And there are instances where if you used to play the arcade game, it will kill you when you're not used to dying. It's good.
I always found it interesting when home ports did stuff like that. And like, maybe you should have the option if you're going, like, if you want to faithfully recreate the game, maybe you should have both versions, the fixed version, which is something they do actually, Hamster do with Arcade Archives sometimes, is they'll fix a bit of game behavior and then give it to you in the options. They'll say, do you want the original or do you want this? I remember when Sales Curve converted Rodland to the Amiga. They fixed in inverted commas some game behavior, but it actually kind of made the game different in some quite fundamental ways. So not always, although they did a wonderful job in many ways, that always struck me as being perhaps a little bit arrogant. It's like, we're gonna take your amazing Japanese single screen arcade game and we'll fix it.
This has never had an Arcade Archives release.
No. I wonder why. Maybe it's the audio issue?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, notable by its absence, though.
Good point. All right. Well, I think all that remains is really for us to wrap up and summarise as best we can. From my point of view, I enjoy both games to an extent, but neither of them is something that I would advocate kind of becoming a master at and dedicating tons and tons of time to. Recommended Atari 50 many times, going to do it again. It's on there, so definitely check it out and try to imagine what it was like being a young-ish person in the late 70s, just 10 years after the moon landing, and not having really had much interactive technology at that point, and thinking about how that might have felt, you know, or not, doesn't matter. It's all history. But and Lunar Rescue is, I think, the more accessible and more easily enjoyable game at this point. Harder to get hold of officially, although you can play it on Antstream, which is cool. Both the versions I've got are sadly do have both. They both have a little bit of input latency. Both the Space Invaders Invincible Collection on the Switch and the Egret 2 Mini are not without a little bit of input lag. Neither of them's crippling. It's not like horribly noticeable. But it means that combined with the possible audio issues as discussed means that it's imperfect, I suppose. But anyway, gives you a lovely sense of what certainly recreates that feeling of the game that I got from that half-remembered experience of playing what I thought was Space Invaders Part 2 for the first time. And it turns out it was a completely different game. So yeah, fun, interesting, glad we covered them. Well, it was my idea because they're both 45. Happy birthday to the Lunar Games. Tony.
They're older than me. Only by a year, but they're older than me.
Just yeah. about.
Yeah, I think kind of in my head, like Lunar Rescue is definitely the more game-playing game. Like there's more of a game there to be had. But strangely, I think I took, which I know is probably slightly different from the many other people on the team here, but I actually took more from Lunar Lander. I think just because of its simplicity, and it just feels like the beginnings of computing in a way, and that's not quite true, but it, yeah, there's an element of its simplicity just being very addicting. Where Lunar Rescue is a bit more, I think, just because it feels a bit more colourful gameplay. It's like it kind of gets amalgamated into many other games like that. So to me, it's like less. What am I thinking? I don't want to say definitive, but it's not that. Instinct. What's our words for like singular?
Instant gratification.
No. Yeah, I don't know. For me, anyway, Lunar Lander feels more. More singular, more of its own thing.
Singular. Yeah. Singular is a perfect
more
word.
Singular. And it feels like that's like a little time capsule in some regards. And I took a lot from that. It just felt like this, you know, going back in, you know, right back into my youth and playing something, you know, quite unique we hate in the show, but it feels like unique for the time.
I don't mind unique when it's true. Yeah. I mean, it certainly is. It's not unique as a band word. It's just misusing it.
I suppose
it
because we are far enough back now that, in fact, it could, like the zoom in scream was unique. So
exactly.
Like it could actually use that word. So I actually took a.
It was, I suppose, I mean, you could say that it took a lot of cues from Space War, computer space. But I mean, actually, the landing concept was. At that in 1979, I think was probably unique. So I think we'll allow it.
Yeah, and I don't think neither game is it. You know, is like the absolute pinnacle or anything. But yeah, I enjoyed my time with both. Lunar Lander in particular, I just had that a little bit more kind of felt a little bit more special to me. Just been fun, just to just chill with two games like that, like super simple, just and. You know, occasionally, you know, Kane and Rince is littered with us going back to some early arcade games and feeling the frustration of what those games are asking. And actually, both these games have, you know, we've talked in the show, have been relatively kind of easy access and simple to just sit down and enjoy, at least for the first, you know, that's one screen for Lunar Lander, but for the first, you know, three screens of my time with Lunar Rescue. So, yeah, overall, enjoyable.
Fun history lesson.
Yeah, absolutely.
Brian, what about you?
I was going to echo pretty much what Tony said at the end there about how when you go back to these games of this era, that it's very, very rare to have, we're covering two in the same show and to not be immediately just being like, oh my God, how hard are these games?
I had to use something in the emulation to allow me to have more lives would normally be the answer to something. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So yeah, so it's interesting that these games are what we're covering in the show. I think that if you have an opportunity to ever go to a retro arcade or an arcade museum or whatever local arcade you might have in your world, wherever you are, and it just, these two games are the example to me of why you should just, like, any machine that you see that even shows a remote interest, you should stop and put a quarter into and give it a shot, because it just, with the way these games control, with the way that they play and the history behind them and the things that came after them, it's just every one of those machines in one of those arcades is the building block to something that you love now, even if you don't love those. And I think that these two games, like, even just to be as dry and boring as possible, which I try not to be, like, from an academic perspective, like, they're fascinating games, and they tell you so much about where games were at the time and where games were going, and just, you think about, and Leanne's mentioned it a few times, I know Chris has too, just how close these games were to other huge games of the era, 1 year, 2 years apart, and you can literally see the evolution from one to the next to the next, and these two are just kind of are big chunks of that, maybe more, a little bit more so with Lunar Lander than Rescue, but it's such a delight to go back to. And I think that if you've listened this far in this podcast, you obviously really care about games. So you should, there's plenty of ways these days to get your hands on. If you can play the real arcade, great. If you can't, there's plenty of ways to play them at home. And even if it's just to look at it and be like, huh, well, that's what that thing is. I think it's of academic value. At the very least, I don't think either one of these games, I don't think you're going to walk away with a bad taste in your mouth, which is not something you can say from all the arcade games of the era.
Nicely put. And let's wrap it up with Chris.
Fun games to play, fun games to talk about. Arguably more fun to talk about than they are to play these days.
Yeah,
look, we've said it, haven't we? Lunar Lander, and I think it's reflected in the amount of time we've spent talking about each game. Lunar Lander, certainly, for me, the most historically significant of the two. But if you've got a room full of friends and you fancy an hour's fun and a little high school competition, I think you could do a lot worse than Lunar Rescue. Everyone will get something out of it because it does start pretty mellow. But Lunar Lander certainly is the one which I think if somebody is doing a Kane and Rince equivalent in 45 years and they're talking about the 90th anniversary of these games, they'll probably spend more time talking about Lunar Lander again than they will about Lunar Rescue, because Lunar Rescue does feel a little bit more, we've said it, it's a bit more gamey, it's a bit more typical of games that were around, whereas Lunar Lander, with that cab and those controls, there were only 5,000 or so sold. Unless people are going to recreate and build them from scratch, they are going to break and then there'll be none left. So if you are ever out and about and you see a Lunar Lander cab, as Brian has said, go and stick some money in it, because one day the last Lunar Lander game will stop and that will be that for that game. Man. The only thing we will have is the quite brilliant emulation, but it's still not quite the same.
Yeah.
And I would say for Lunar Rescue, the best way to play it nowadays, I would say, is actually this modern specy version. So go and give the guy... you can buy the guy a coffee on itch.io and download it. His name escapes me now. High Riser, maybe the name he goes by. But if you search for Lunar Rescue RX on itch, you can buy that there. And it's worth your time. It's worth half an hour of anyone's time. But this has been a fun conversation to have. Well,
let
us
know in
games.
2064 if you're playing Lunar Lander.
Well, these games are not older than me, by the way. I am younger, so I just wanted to get that in there. So I could
well,
be
as
around
I said at the very start, there's no way we can record a two-hour show about these two games, you know.
Of course we can. Leon told me all the time that we can do that on any game.
Absolutely. Give me a challenge. I'll accept
it. It's been a pleasure.
So, there we go. Another show. It just remains for me, Leon, to thank Brian, Chris, Tony, Editor Jay, our correspondents, and of course, you for listening. And don't forget, you can get these shows earlier and oftentimes extended just by joining our Patreon, patreon.com/CaneAndRince, $2 a month. And you get an exclusive monthly podcast, as was previously advertised by Chris with myself and Jay. We also have merch back on sale via my Spreadshop, Spreadshirt, as well as clothes, clobber, t-shirts, hoodies. There's also hats and cups and other vessels and items. Check it out. It all helps. Next time, in issue 624, a brand new game, but also a 20-year-old game. Paper Mario, The Thousand-Year Door.
I'm back, right? Okay, engine stop. APA at a descent. Hose control both auto. Descent engine command override off. Engine arm off. Port 13 is in.
We've had shut down.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Okay, everybody, T1, stand by for T1.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.